Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you all enjoyed your lunch and had a lovely meal. We're going to be starting off this afternoon's proceedings with Andy Clean. He's going to be talking about the kernel hacker generation and the community that's associated with the kernel and how it's changed over time. So, Andy, it's all yours.
Thank you. First of all, say it's about multiple generations, not only a single one. I just want to stress that point. But okay. First, I must say the Linux kernel has been around for quite a long time now, I think since 91. And I haven't actively been around in the Linux kernel for that long, like some other people have, like Linus or Ted or so, but not me. But I've been around for quite a long time, and I've been watching the people who are working on it for a long time, and I noticed that, for example, at specific times, there were actually new people going into the Linux kernel and writing new code and basically appearing and doing new work. Other people were disappearing, and I was always for some time thinking about in like a generation of kernel hackers, because often the people who are new appear at some time, they're doing something similar or they're looking similar or so on. And I actually, first I was thinking, because I remembered some name and so on, actually doing some data mining on Linux kernel, mailing list archives and so on, and giving them names and dates and data, hard data. But then I figured out, actually, I don't like data mining very much, because I'm not actually NSA or Google. So instead of giving you actually dates that I get from mailing list archives, I'm just giving you some trends as I notice them. And I must say, my memory is not perfect. So first, it's more newer trends than older trends, simply because the older trends I don't always remember. And of course, always only the trends I see, not more general trends, perhaps. And it's also the trends, as I give them, are not necessarily temporarily ordered. So it gives you various generations. I call them generations still. They're not actually generations, but more trends. But I like the name generations, so I kept that. And there's the ordering of them is not as they appeared in time. So actually, as I talk about them, it's not, you cannot say it happened in that order. But there's a little bit of overlap and so on, but it shouldn't matter. And as I said, talking about newer stuff more than older stuff. But some older stuff is also present. So let's say more from the last few years than before that. And one first thing I want to talk about is the janitor generation. That's an interesting one. Basically, like when you have, and Linux kernel is a very big project with a lot of source code and so on. And generally, when you have very large software projects, then they tend to need a lot of maintenance, because over time, specific items that you use in the source code change or things like that. And normally, like in commercial development, there's actually often not much time to do cleanup, because commercial development is often very focused on only getting releases out, getting features out, but nobody's actually doing the cleanups. And Linux kernel always had more luck with cleanups, because there were actually people volunteering that. But at some point, there were some people like Arnaldo Melho or Rick van Riel, who actually defined, made a new grab to get new people for new kernel developers, which they called the kernel janitors. Basically, a kernel janitor is a newbie developer who is not really, doesn't know enough yet to do a big change or a big new feature, but just they know enough C and enough programming to do a small change, small cleanups and so on. And there was actually a mailing list for that, also called kernel janitors, and a website. And they recruited people and they did lots of changes there. And they actually had quite a lot of new developers from that. Of course, they mostly did simple changes, like for example, going over the source code and clean up the code in simple ways and so on. But there was actually quite a lot of changes coming out of that. And one thing what happened first is, so in some cases, for example, you're doing a change, for example, you're replacing an obsolete function call with a new one or things like that, then you actually often generate a lot of changes, a lot of patches, because usually if it's not manageable if you do a single patch which does all these changes, because it conflicts with other patches and so on. So usually what they do is generate lots of small patches that change, for example, one drive and change another driver, send it to the various maintainers and so on for them to merge. And originally when they started, we still had some trouble there with merging patches, like that right now the infrastructure works great. They can actually, the Linux kernel group can actually merge patches very quickly. But at this point, we always had what we called merging bottleneck. So where it's actually sometimes the patches got lost, or it's simple, the infrastructure for the for getting the releases out couldn't handle that many patches. But now it works mostly to Git and some other changes, like various very great people were doing the work and so on. And so kernel janitors over time did a lot of changes to the code. And actually what they're doing basically is keeping the code clean, like a janitor does. It just, janitor keeps care of the house, and kernel janitors keep care of some code, of small parts of the code. But one problem I see with the kernel janitors in general is there's not really a process to graduate them to more complex projects. Because the idea basically of kernel janitors was to start with easy stuff and then get them to more, perhaps get them later to do more complex contributions. But currently right now, we seem to have some people who get stuck, for example, as kernel janitors, or that are not helped enough to do more. That's, maybe it will change in the future. We'll see what happens there. Okay, another generation that happened some time ago, this was what I call a login name tree generation. At some point, we had various people, various kernel developers, who actually had an own tree of patches. And this was based on their login name. For example, we had the AA tree. Actually, AA, that's standing for Andrea Arcangeli, it's not his login name. His login name is Andrea, but it's often the login name. Anyways, basically what happened there when we still were in the merging crisis means that there were more patches on the mailing list than the Linux kernel could actually merge. Then often patches wouldn't get merged, or they would drop down and ignored and so on. So what happened is that people were actually, some kernel developers actually did some changes on their own. They also merged patches and then released trees based on their login name, and then other people used these trees. Like, for example, the AA tree was from Andrea. He first had all the changes for his memory management work he did, and then merged a lot of other changes. Actually, the AA tree, at least for during the 2.2 kernel, was at some point the de facto 2.2 kernel, because at least several distributions were shipped based on it, and lots of people were using it, because the standard 2.2 kernel were just too slow merging the patches. And the AC tree from Alan Cox was also similar. At some point, it had a lot of changes, and were going in and later. Anyways, and we had then a trend at some point, because then a lot of other people were also starting to do their own login name trees, and it became quite interesting. We had also quite a lot of releases, release mails all the time on Linux kernel that said, oh, the blah blah tree is released now. I think it didn't actually work to have that many of these trees, because basically to make these login name trees useful, you actually need you need enough users for them, because they're only useful when they actually get tested and then later when the patches are tested in the login name tree, they get merged into mainline, because then you can say, okay, it has been tested there and some users found it good and usable. But if you have too many of them, then the user base is scattered, the tester base cannot keep up with them, because you can usually only run one of them. So, but it worked at the end, I would say. I think some of the smaller ones basically died off. Right now we don't have many of these trees anymore. Mostly I think they got replaced by one big tree, just the MM tree from Andrew Morton. But we still have some smaller trees, but from various people. And of course, what we have is, for example, the maintainers of various features still have their own trees for stuff. Usually, for example, things like the PowerPC tree or the block device driver tree and some other things where people were, the maintainers are doing their work or merging the patches into that one. And then it gets into, but the problem is usually people don't want to run single feature branches, don't want to test them. Because if somebody wants to test something, they want to have a tree that does lots of things. They're not usually not interested in only a single feature. So the more topical trees get now pulled into the big tree and the MM tree. And what we also have as different trees are the distribution trees. And I found it quite interesting because at some point, basically, that you had so many trees at this point that it showed that there was a problem there. And then eventually it got resolved basically when the patch infrastructure was, for example, first with BitKeeper and then with JIT was improved to merge more patches. And eventually many of these trees disappeared again. But it was interesting. And I found it interesting the people who were doing these trees because I personally had never had a login name tree simply because I was too lazy about this. So I always release a new tree. But I found it interesting that so many people were motivated doing this. Okay, and then another generation appeared basically, I think around 2000 it started, something like this. Then suddenly Linux became big business. Before that, of course, there were some corporate users, but usually they were just people who were solving their specific problem. But at some point we had basically companies deciding, okay, Linux is a great thing, and we invest money into it, in the development. And they were actually starting to pay people to work full-time on specific things they were defining and so on. And it was quite interesting for the kernel community because suddenly they had a lot of new developers going in, basically appearing out of nowhere. Often even people who have been working on other operating system for a long time, like old Unix people and other people and so on. And it was quite interesting because there was a little bit of a culture clash here, how these people learn to work with the main kernel. And the first thing, of course, that there are different kind of companies who want to contribute to the kernel. The first thing is hardware vendors, which just want to have the drivers in. So usually what happens, they write a driver, and then, or they write a driver for Linux, and then say, okay, how do we merge the driver? How do we get in mainline? How do we get in distribution? What they usually do, they first try to talk to the distributions, and then the distributions say, but we don't want to maintain the driver for you. We want to get it into mainline first. Then at some point they learned to get patches into mainline first. And there were already some changes here. Then the next thing that we had, for example, what they called the hooks people. So basically at some point people were starting to do some various features on top of Linux. And often what you got there in Linux kernel was they were asking, okay, we have this great thing that we want to do, and we don't want to put it in the standard kernel yet, but we just need a hook there so we can do it. So for example, basically when you are, a standard example of hook is, for example, LSM, where you have various security modules that can be plugged in, or hook is netfilter, where you can do all kind of advanced firewalling on top of it. Or then there are people who wanted, for example, a special accounting, so they needed special hooks in the context switches, and actually not in the context switches, but in task creation, so they can keep track of tasks and all kinds of other stuff. And there was always the joke, because we get so many requests for hooks, because Linux is so popular now that a lot of people want to do things on top of Linux. So that if there's no throttling with the hooks, at some point there will be more hook code in the kernel than other code. So I'm not sure it will happen. It's always interesting because basically often when people want to have a hook, it's actually necessary to talk to them first, because usually they want to do things completely separate, but often there's a much better solution that doesn't need to hook, or that does extend some feature that's already in the kernel and so on. Anyways, there was a quite interesting education process of people who wanted to add hooks. And one thing that also happened from the commercial people, for example, we had several bigger companies who say, okay, we had this other operating system before and we're now porting some features from the other operating systems there. For example, a big company with three letters was very big on that one, but also other companies. And it's actually interesting because often they developed big patch then, did complete QA and everything. But they did complete patches at some point and posted them, and you got a big patch, but then said, oh, it's actually not how we want to do things. Yeah? First, we were pretty annoyed because they already put so much work into it. And then another problem is if you get a big patch, you actually need somebody to find somebody to review it. And when you when you want somebody to review it, you need first somebody to be interested in you, because reviewing is a lot of work. And often we had cases, for example, that when there was not enough interest in the community for a particular feature, there would actually no reviewer. So people would post patches or pointers to patches, say, okay, that's a great feature that we would like to have. But then they weren't very good at hyping their feature, and then it wouldn't actually get merged. For example, my standard example on this one is dprobes versus kprobes. Dprobes, if anybody knows it, was an early attempt by IBM. It originated on OS2, I think. Basically, it was something, a way where you can load little scripts into the kernel and they can measure things. For example, basically what now SystemTap and kprobes are doing. And they had these great patches for doing them and reposting them, but nobody was interested in them. So in the end, they basically died off because they just figured out if there's no interest, we cannot merge them. And the funny thing was, what happened later, a few years later, then there was suddenly from another operating system, from Solaris, a big hype about dtrace, and everybody was saying, oh, dtrace is the big killer feature and everything, but dtrace was basically the same thing as dprobes. So if we had basically had the review bandwidth, or if they had managed to attract enough people to review the code and merge the code, then dprobes had been merged, then Linux would have had a feature that's very similar to dtrace several years ago. And this also happened with quite a lot of other features. So there's actually, basically we had this problem that the people the commercial people weren't basically not good enough to sell their stuff to the mailing list. So that is actually get somebody else does the work of cleaning it up and merging it. And another thing, okay, so this earlier already, they first developed the stuff in a closed way and delivered and finished and create patch. And it's actually quite different because in Linux, normally in commercial and closed development, usually what happens is some developer is assigned to do some code, and then they do the code, and then maybe they find another person to review the code, which is assigned to do this, and then they check it into the source control system. But in Linux, it works like this. Basically, you write code, then you publish it on a public mailing list. And then you need to attract some people who review it and so on and say, yeah, I like this, or I don't like this, or basically you need to publish it. And if you're a new person, okay, if somebody is already established, then people usually tend to look at it, or it gets easily merged because the maintainers like it. But if there's something new, then basically you need to attract some attention from people so they actually look at it and work with them to make it, because usually most of these patches need some changes to be actually mergeable. So that's patch publishing model is actually quite different. I think that was a big culture shock for some of the commercial people. And what I said earlier already, the submissions often were very lossy because of that, because basically they were just throwing the patch on the mailing list, but they weren't very good at actually getting people to look at it and so on. So we lost a lot of stuff there. I was often compared to TCP when you're basically losing a packet. And then some people would do a retransmit a few times, but actually in this case, you actually have to do a little bit different and maybe send smaller patches first or describe actually why you want to do the patch and so on. But finally, these problems mostly resolved. We got a lot better, I think, at educating new people how to do this. And a lot of companies learned how to do this properly. For example, in general, the kernel mailing lists, they want to have attention. The kernel mailing list is very annoyed if they just get thrown something that's where they haven't never heard of before. So, for example, it's much better to first send some early patches that are not perfect yet, and then basically improve them and so on. For example, a standard way that I think Chris Mason says this first, a good way to solve a problem, even if you don't know actually how to solve the problem, is to write a completely crappy patch and then send a crappy patch to the mailing list and then wait for people to improve it. And eventually people will improve it, will generate a good patch, and then you have a good feature that you can merge and so on. And tricks like this basically had to be learned. And for some companies still have problems with merging stuff, but it's a lot better now. I think basically what's still a problem is when some groups are writing a lot of code, then the review is a problem, because basically you need a lot of work to do actually code review, and code review is very important for Linux. And we don't have the bandwidth for that, so that's one issue with commercial people. But anyways, the next generation I want to have, I call them the Russian Mathematicans. I must first say, they're not actually all Russian Mathematicans, but I just found out that a lot of them are either Russians or Mathematicans or both. So I found it was a catchy name. And there was especially some people there, for example, people will recognize who I mean with that one, where they basically were suggesting, at some point, some very clever people appeared on the mailing list and were starting to do changes. And they were really, really good changes. And there was really at least one person who people suspected that this actually was a group of hackers acting in a single name because he was so productive at some point. But of course, not all of them are so good. But basically, we got some very bright people which appear in mailing list and do very good changes and solve tricky problems. And that's actually quite good because over the time, the kernel got a lot harder. For example, one big thing that's very complicated right now is when you're doing SMP scaling or MP scaling, and you have lots of problems with memory ordering and lockless data structures, which is sometimes very hard to solve. And then we are always glad if you have some very bright people who can solve these particular problems. For example, some of the races in there are very hard to look, very hard to find in code. And so if you have some very bright people, that they help. But in the end, I actually hope that we don't need them anymore, because as the saying goes, debugging is twice as hard as writing the code. And when somebody has to be really, really bright to write some code, and then nobody else can debug it anymore, maybe themselves even cannot debug it anymore. So actually, the ideal what would like to have is that you have much simpler code that doesn't need a genius or a very bright person to actually write or look at or debug. Because then, even if you have to debug it later, then even still a normal person, or maybe a bright person, with code that has been written by a normal person, and a bright person can debug it, or hopefully even the normal person can still debug it. So in the end, I hope that basically we can make the infrastructure and so on, the kernel, simple enough that, for example, even for MP scaling and so on, we don't need these kind of people. Anyways, we're still glad that we have them. And then another generation that we're getting recently, it's a flame generation. I noticed that, for example, that the tone on the mailing list are sometimes getting more and more nasty. What I noticed, for example, is a lot of people act very different when they are an email than in person. For example, I found out cases in the past where I was actually first read somebody's emails, and they were always very aggressive, and I thought, oh, what a nasty person. Hopefully, I will never meet him. But then, at some point, when I actually met him at some conference, and I found out that they're completely different in person. So some people seem to have basically problems with, they don't restrain themselves in emails as they do in person. So, and we, of course, always in Linux kernel, or always in the internet, you had to have flames. So where you send somebody a nasty gram, which you probably shouldn't have sent, and so on. But I somehow get the feeling that the tone gets a little bit worse over time. And when, for example, some review things where people are saying, oh, that's total crap, or that's stupid, or they're even doing ad hominem attacks, and so on. And because people are seeing these flames on the mailing list, I think they probably think it's okay to do these flames, but it's not. First, I must actually say, I also flame people. So I cannot say that I never flame people, and I probably sometimes, okay, I have to excuse because I'm not a native English speaker, I must say, I didn't know what I was saying. That's a trick, but other people don't have this excuse. But what I especially notice is during review, because during review, if you see some stupid code, then okay, it's good, okay to say that it's not good or even stupid code, but you don't need to go directly at the person, which I sometimes see. And what I noticed, and I even heard this privately from some people, is that it actually, because nobody's new and is not used to that one, then they're actually thinking that the people are hating them. So it's actually danger of scaring people away. And some people are more sensitive, because basically if you know somebody for some years, even for mailing lists, then you know that even if they flame you, that they don't hate you. But for new people, that's much more difficult to determine. So I would hope that people are thinking twice before flaming more. But anyways, that's a flame generation. I hope it will slowly go away. Probably will not, but first of all, I thought it interesting to describe it. Then another generation that we have more recently now, is they call it deadline generation. That's also, okay, I'm probably idealizing it a little bit, but long-scale development used to be more relaxed. We didn't actually have too much deadlines, and the deadlines, or whatever deadlines were there, releases or code freezes, were usually quite unpredictable. So you never knew exactly when Linux would do a release or when it would happen or so on. And so people were actually not working towards dates, because usually in closed development and so on, people usually work towards specific dates and they have very, very strict deadlines and so on. But it didn't used to be that bad in this case for mainline kernel development. But now we got the famous 2-week merge windows. Basically, every time there's a release, there's a 2-week window where all the big patches are going in, and after that, it's only code freeze or smaller patches or obvious bug fixes and so on. First, there's still a problem. It's unpredictable when the window opens because you don't know exactly when the release will be, but you can usually guess now because it's usually a predictable schedule that every week there's an RC release and at some point there's a release. But for example, sometimes the cycles are are smaller than others. For example, 2.6.20 was a much shorter, or is going to much shorter than 6.19. But anyways, still people are working towards the deadlines here. And I have the feeling that people are a lot more pressured than they were before. So at least for me, it's, for example, because I know, okay, we are at RC5, and we really have to get that feature out for the next merge window, because otherwise it has to wait for 2 months or so. So you basically, then you're working a lot faster and you're feeling the pressure and you're starting to sweat and so on. So, and also the other people are feeling this. For example, I got the impression that, okay, when you have other contributors, then I would expect that if they have more freedom, they're actually more happy. So if they don't have deadlines and so on, then they have more time to do things. But I found actually, when they have more time now. But actually, I found out that at least some people seem to be more happy when they have deadlines. That's an interesting thing. We would expect that people are glad that they don't have specific deadlines, but actually they seem to be more, are they need a deadline, or they're so used to having the deadline or so on, I don't know. Anyways, I think that has the deadlines or the merge windows have changed the development quite a lot. Of course, I say it also has disadvantages. For example, if you're a maintainer, you're expected to send a lot of patches during the 2-week window, and it happens when you're on vacation, and you you lost the release, but then you have to do it quickly or so on. But I think it has changed the development quite a lot. Okay, the next one, that's a developing generation. I call it tester generation. Actually, it's a little bit of a wishful thinking in there, so I'm hoping that it will get more and more. But traditionally, the Linux kernel, it has a specific problem, because normally, like for example, when you have something like compiler or some other tool, that you can very nicely do regression tests that are static. So you have some scripts or some input, and always the same output comes out of it, and then you basically can find regressions very quickly and can have a nice regression test seed and so on and so on. But for the kernel, it's a lot harder because there's a lot of hardware which people don't, which the normal developers don't have. So then there's not only specific devices, but also, for example, there are thousands of different types of PC, or 100,000s, and all of them have usually different quirks and bugs. So you cannot often predict when you do a change. The only way to actually see if a change is good or bad is to actually throw it out to the user base and see if it works for everybody, because it basically cannot be tested statically. Of course, there are lots of bugs which can be tested by the developers. So usually they're expected to write code that has been tested by themselves. But you always have to do a regression test then on larger user base. And we don't, because that we also normally don't have formal QA on kernel.org, because it would be just too hard. First, the time is not enough, because basically the release is every 2 months. So, and formal QA takes a long time if it's done well. And the normal model there is that instead rely on the distributions to do the bigger QA, because they have more resources and more time. They have longer release schedules. But there are other problems, because the traditional model basically that, okay, the maintainers are doing some testings, or some simple testings, and it's thrown out to the early testers who are testing a kernel before it's released, like RC kernel and so on. And then more people, when the kernel is released, are testing it, and then the bugs are getting back into stable or so on. But a problem that we had at some point is, because the distributions kernels are so good now, because people often don't upgrade to the kernel.org kernels or change to the kernel.org kernels, because they just use what was delivered on the CD and they don't change it. And so we had a little bit of a testing problem, because sometimes we had the problem that a lot of bugs were only found when some big distributions did the next release, because only they had enough user coverage and so on. There are some steps in this direction which are going better. For example, distributions are better now and actively pushing out kernel.org kernels. So you can get RPMs of the kernel.org kernels now from, like, I think Fedora and SUSE also has it now and some others probably. And that helps for testing, because it makes it easier for people. They don't have to compile the kernel to actually test it. But the tester generation, okay, that was testing, but the tester generation basically is doing is, or we found out at some point there were people who were getting more and more interested, because we found, okay, you can do a lot of testing by cursor people. They just boot Linux on the workstation and report if it works or not. But a lot of the things that Linux is doing cannot be easily tested on a workstation, because it's well beyond what you normally do in a workstation, because workstation doesn't normally stress kernels all that much, at least in most cases. So there were people who were starting to do regression testing. There were projects like LTP and some test scripts and other things. And we actually also had some internal test code from distributions who started to get released. And another thing that we found out that, for example, some people were starting to do recently now is internal testing in the kernel. So for example, one thing that I really liked is there was somebody bought a tool to do malloc failures. So because the kernel internally has a malloc function, and it would just test, okay, does this driver explode when you fail some mallocs and things like this. So basically, because normally when you are running normally the kernel running, can't run the kernel normally, then you don't test error paths all that well. So you need basically inject errors to test them. And we had some people writing this code, and I think that's the developing tester generation. And I'm hoping there will be more of these people, like, basically write code, write test suites, test specific stuff that stress the kernel, and write internal test code and so on. And test code is not often tested to regression testing. And I see some signs of this. Like, okay, there's a lot of testing seems to be still done in for distributions, which is bad, because if the testing is done in distribution, then it's private to the distribution. Okay, the bug fixes usually go back to mainline at some point, but it would be much nicer to space it out over a longer time, so it's done in mainline, and then when the distribution does a release, it gets the already tested and better tested kernel. And of course, the people who don't want to run distribution kernels would just get kernel or kernels also want to have earlier QA and so on. So I'm hoping basically that we can have more testers in mainline. Another generation, MC slowly developing, more slowly than the tester generation, is what I call the bugmaster generation. And the interesting question here, when you do a release, for example, what the maintainers ask, or the release managers ask, when they do a release, on what does it depend? Does it depend on time? No, it depends on the bugs. So how many bugs you have, do you have still critical bugs and so on? And it's actually quite hard to know. I think we had, at some point ago, we had an discussion on how buggy is the Linux kernel. And nobody actually knew, because the first, okay, we have some bug databases like Bugzilla kernel.org or distribution Bugzillas and some other things. But first there's Catdat. And nobody knows, for example, how many duplicates then, how many bugs in there are dead or not dead. And then a lot of bugs actually don't get even reported to these bug databases. But basically, there's no person who actually has an overview over how is the bug rate really looking. So we're actually a little bit in the dark here. We are hoping that the bug rate doesn't go up that badly. I don't think, for example, we had 10,000 bugs like Andrew Tannenbaum said, or maybe not 10,000 CS bugs that people are running and hitting in practice, but we are not completely sure. That's the problem. So, and I think what we basically need here is people who actually like go through the bug databases and look at them and do the various things that you need to do on the bug database. So basically, they need to look at the bug databases. So what does a bug master do? Work with the bug reporters to get the basic information, because first when you get something in Bugzilla, often it's actually pretty crap, because most people don't know how to get bug reports. So actually, but it's difficult because it usually gets assigned, a bug gets assigned to the maintainer, and then the maintainer has to ask the people all the information, which is a lot of strain on the maintainers. But it would be good. There are actually some people who are doing this, like for example in Bugzilla and kernel.org Bugzilla, who are going through bugs and asking them to provide information and so on. Another thing that's very important is tune duplicates, because most people don't check if the bug has been already reported. And it's sometimes difficult to detect the duplicate, especially if it's scattered over multiple bug databases. So, and that's basically need some people who have know a lot of bugs, and even different bugs, and then can actually move the duplicates that we get, weed out dead bugs. Often bugs are dead for old releases, and nobody knows if it's still there in the latest release or not. Set proper priorities. Some bugs are very obscure. Some bugs are release critical. So that we actually know, for example, we have lots of critical bugs. Of course, that's it's sometimes hard to say what is a critical bug or not. So usually the release managers have to decide at some point, like, or the maintainers. But it's still a lot of obvious things that can be done. NAC maintainers fix their bugs. Not always maintainers react to bugs quickly. That's especially a problem because traditionally Linux kernel mainline didn't use Bugzilla. So, like, there are some projects that basically rotate around Bugzilla. For example, if you're looking at Mozilla or so on, they do everything as a bug. Or I think they don't even know how to write email in some cases anymore. They just write it in the bug. But for Linux, it's basically a foreign thing, a foreign language. So a lot of people don't want to have anything to do with Bugzilla. So they just ignore them, as the maintainers or the people who wrote the code. And then they need basically somebody to send them email and ask them, and what does it do? And then maybe ask somebody else and so on. Keeping track of regressions, so you actually know. But it's much more worse for software projects to have a regression. So a bug basically, something that you fixed already or that was working, not working anymore, that's much worse than having a new feature that just doesn't work. Because in the old release, the new feature wasn't there anyways. Okay, if it's buggy, if it doesn't work, then it's not as bad as having the old feature breaking. And it's very important to figure out do you have regressions, because the regressions need to be fixed. We actually have somebody tracking the regressions now for releases, but it's still very much ad hoc, and I think he could use a lot of help and so on. And one thing I must say, a bug master doesn't need to be an expert on any kernel areas, because most of the things they're doing are pretty high-level stuff. You don't need to, for example, fix actually the bug. You just need to ask them, can you give the basic information, like what kernel release you're using, or in what kernel release did the bug not happen, and things like this. Or if there's anything tricky about this, they can just always ask the maintainer or some person who is actually writing the code. And what they don't need to do, they don't need to actually fix the bugs. So the bug master is not the person who fixes the bugs. It just manages the bugs and tells other bugs, tells other people what bugs are around. And in general, currently right now it's done by the release managers, but it's hard to keep track of all the stuff. So basically know what state a release is in, but how many bugs you have, and how Linux is doing. Because right now we don't really know how buggy Linux is. And hopefully somebody will know at some point, and I hope that will be the bug master generation. And as said, there are some people who are starting to do this, but need a lot more. So if you want to become famous, maybe you can join a bug master, or become a bug master. Okay. Another one that's slowly developing, that's also some wishful thinking of on my side here, this technical writer generation. Like we have some people now, for example, we have a new man page maintainer, which should be actually, at least he's on a conference, I'm not sure if he is in this room. But basically, like Linux is an extremely complex project. I'm running out of time?
Running over time.
Okay, then we'll do this generation still. And complex system needs a lot of documentation, especially internal documentation. Like, for example, you have something called kernel doc where you can write document comments on functions and so on. But and then you can actually generate PDFs out of it and get a book out of it and print it out. But the problem, there's no editor. So you have this interesting thing that some obscure function that actually nobody knows really needs are documented, and some really core functions are not documented. So back to you, what we would need to have is some people who are doing basically what the editor does and going over the stuff and making this actually usable. And of course, maintain the main pages, and perhaps in future, because Linux documentation tends to be always scattered around lots of stuff. So even for the kernel, you need to need lots of different sources, work on a great unified Linux documentation tree. Okay, that's my wish. I'm not sure it will happen, but. Okay, do you have enough time? Okay, no, no. I will skip that one. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Andy, for that.